Welcome back. This is the second part of a two-part December podcast focusing on the Future Directions of Medical Education plenary session that took place at the 2016 ASME meeting. If you haven't heard part one, please go back to iTunes and listen to that one first, as it will help this recording make a lot more sense.
The theme for this year's meeting is Medical Education, Historical Perspectives, and Future Directions. And today we have the great delight of having three scholars talk about their perspectives on where the field is heading. Each of these individuals I'm sure you know quite well already. Jerry Gormley, who's a clinical academic at Queen's University Belfast. Fiona Patterson is a professor of organizational psychology and leading expert in the field of assessments, selection, and innovation in organizations. And last but not least, Kees van der Vleuten. He joined the University of Maastricht in 1982, where he was appointed professor of education and chair in the Department of Educational Development and Research.
I'd just like to pick up some of what Ron's been saying there, and also pick up, Kevin, what you said earlier. And I think whilst I take on board the necessity and the value of having patients involved at all levels, we do have to be sensitive to the fact that the delivery of healthcare is by people. And I think we miss that point a lot. It's all systems, it's all processes, it's all time limited, it's regulated, it's whatever else. The thing that we miss is the crucial reliance on people to do it. And if we look at the evidence that we have out there, for example, the National Training Surveys and the GMC have shown over the last goodness knows how many years that foundation doctors particularly find it a very stressful environment. If we look at the stuff from current selection recruitment to specialty training in the UK, this year we had 52% of our foundation doctors applied in the first round for specialty training. Now, that means 48% of them didn't. The other stuff, if you look at the work that Jen Cleland and I have published in the journal earlier this year, we demonstrate that the workplace and the importance of good working conditions in there is what guides people to make career decisions. So I think there's a stack of evidence out there that what we have to think about in future is not so much about the patient, it's not so much about what the patient is getting, but there is a very important component about what the doctor, what the nurse, what every other healthcare worker is doing, but what they are doing is delivering parts of themselves, giving, certainly we're paid for it, but it's giving emotional support, the relationship, all these human things that we deliver, those are vital. And the environment within which we do that, we have to do something to improve that environment and reduce the sausage factory Fordism, as Tim was talking about earlier. We have to reduce that and make it a more human process which people can relate to. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think that if we want to provide a good quality healthcare service, we got to look after those who provide the service, and dealing with those issues of the pressure of work and complexity, that we need to not lose sight of the human face and why they work.
Yeah. It's actually a nice transition point, Peter, because when you mention the word future, many of us immediately start thinking of technology. But some of the questions that are coming up and some of the tweets I'm seeing go by are really talking about the culture of medicine and medical education. And I just saw one that asked about how we move beyond the state of students admitting weakness by virtue of acknowledging the stress that they're feeling or any uncertainty. Have you any thoughts on where we're headed in terms of enabling a culture that perhaps draws more on some of the positives that have been seen in other places like the music world that Tim spoke of this morning?
It's a tough question. I'll just make some comment on that. I mean, it's interesting. We've just been doing a piece of work, Jen and I and Sandra Nicholson, on looking at the culture within medical schools and in relation to medical school admissions. And this particular emphasis there has been looking at encouraging widening access and use of contextual data within admissions. And really where we've got to at the end of that piece of work is that needs to be culture change within universities and medical schools about sort of attitudes and beliefs towards that, which needs to be evidence-based, and a lot of work's going on that's very well-intentioned, but it's often ill-informed in terms of the evidence base. And is there really a will to do that? So I think going back to the broadest issue that Peter raised around the organisational culture, certainly within the UK and the careers, and the sort of psychological contract that's been broken in many ways in the UK for junior doctors and the problems we found ourselves in very recently, it's going to be very difficult to mend. And I think that came out of modernising medical careers, which was well-intentioned and looking at competence-based education, but became, I think you described it, as a sausage mill. And people were saying this is a big system, and the economists got involved, but people forgot the human beings involved in that process. So, yeah, I do think it's time for culture change, and the discourse has to change to be more positive, because at the moment it's not.
Case.
I guess Chris Watling's work also demonstrated that compared to music and to sports, medicine is a pretty feedback-poor environment in terms of training. And I guess that culture has to change as well, particularly if we agree on the fact that experiential learning and work-based learning is absolutely essential. Well, there's massive evidence showing that learners in workplaces want feedback, not getting it. So I guess that's the kind of culture change that we have to achieve as well.
Thinking about the broader aspects of culture even, we're in a state now, as Val just reminded us, of having to worry about bringing various cultures into the medical training programs for the sake of social accountability, to just drop another hot button topic into the conversation. Fiona, again, I'll come back to you first because you've done so much work in the selection realm. Where do you think we're heading in terms of enabling the diversity and the widening access sorts of issues that are very prevalent here and elsewhere?
Yeah, very neatly with what Jerry's interests are in terms of that public engagement. So in some ways, certainly some talks I've delivered recently, we're looking back at the archives of the Yale Medical School's admission system, in the 1920s, and it's almost 100 years ago, and they were struggling with the same issues then in terms of how to widen access. At that time, they were sort of actively deselecting Catholics, Jews, and Afro-Americans, and largely your post was determined by whether you could pay or not. And clearly, people were unhappy with that, and things had changed quite significantly. But in some ways, I think we're still grappling with the same issues around widening access and diversity. And Cynthia's talk yesterday made me feel that we have been incremental in addressing those issues rather than transformational. In some ways, probably before we get to our sort of take-home message, I do think we need a paradigm shift in the way that we think about widening access in selection and admissions, which connects, I think, to what Jerry's also interested in public engagement.
Coming from those points, I really commend the work of what we're doing to try to increase widening access for entrance to our healthcare professional courses. But we see the challenges there, that it's difficult. We never can get the ultimate gold standard method. And just this, the unintended consequences that we see, I'm sure we've all kind of seen the proliferation now of the MMI preparation courses that are quite expensive to pay to go to, and maybe not all members of society can pay for that. So I think where we look where our tensions are, we need to make sure we keep our eye on the unintended consequences that can have a ripple effect.
Can I just come back on that? Just again, Cynthia's point is down. I remember writing it down thinking that there's a lot of scope for innovation if we started to look at some of the things we've introduced, and myself, my team, in terms of assessments we might have developed, and then they have unintended consequences, or modernising medical careers was done with good intention, but lots of unintended consequences. And I think that's an exciting agenda or theme for further research in looking at the aftermath of when things have been introduced. What does that actually mean, and what have we learnt from that? And perhaps we don't really think about that as researchers. I am certainly guilty of that. I think just coming back to the point that you just made, Joe, with MMIs, and we've done a lot of work on SJTs. We've just published an article in this month's issue in medical education on looking at widening access using situational judgment tests, which seems to suggest you could level the playing field because it's less affected by socioeconomic status compared to academic attainment and A-levels and so on, which seems quite obvious in some ways when you think about it. But in the simulations we've done, you'd have to something like quadruple the weighting of the SGT compared to the other tools, and I don't think there's an appetite for anybody to want to do that, unless, for example, we do shift our thinking in heavily relying just on academic attainment as our main first sift, then we'll never address widening access.
Cynthia.
Thank you, Cynthia Whitehead from Toronto. All of this conversation about culture, I think, is really important, and it's interesting we're talking about it at so many different levels. Now, culture amongst medical students, amongst medical educators, culture incorporating patient and diversity of culture. I think all of these things are absolutely essential, which made me start thinking, I didn't take a picture of what you said the goal of the journal was, but it seemed to me, if I remember it correctly, it's about enabling and supporting medical educators which suggests a focus on the individual medical educator. And I wonder, with all of this important conversation about culture, is that actually what we as a community want to do? Or is there a larger social, structural, institutional piece of medical education that we should perhaps add, education as a system,
yeah,
including the cultural aspect?
I couldn't agree more. I think we tend to focus very much on the individual and on the educational technology. And I think that the issue in terms of innovation is not so much about educational technology, but about change management, in which culture is very, very important, and people's beliefs are very important. And I find it quite interesting that in the literature, very little is published on management of change. I find that quite interesting. I think that's an area that we should further explore a lot. I mean, in the past, we've been paying a lot of attention to faculty development. But again, that's targeted towards the individual. And it's not in the individual that we need to change. It's the wider system. And we need to address it also in our research.
I totally echo your comments, Cynthia, that we often focus on the individual level, but there's such a wider gaze that we can cast, and there's so many areas. We have the tensions between service delivery and learning. We know that education will make a difference, but actually allowing individuals to come together. So we need to have messages that get across to organizing. I think we have to demonstrate our value of what we are and what we can do, and the relevance of what we can do to daily practice, to patient good, or our public face. And there also is an important group of individuals who are clinicians, who are engaged in education, who would like to get an education, who can't, maybe aren't able to. So we need to be in partnership with them. We need to speak to them as a community. We need to, dare I say, break down some of our academic ivory towers and say that this is actually what we're doing is relevant to you. We need you, you need us. We need to work in partnerships so we can try to grasp opportunities. But most importantly, we need to grab a bigger gaze than just the person.
Vince Cooper from Keele. I'd like to put together some of the points that have been made and ask you to respond to what is the connection between competency-based assessment and Tim's point about the need for excellence and how competency is only one component, and also relate that to the issue of feedback. And I've got a serious concern that competency-based assessment leads to a lot of cherry-picking by politicians. It's very easy to just pick out the easily measurable. Case was saying, but we must value that which isn't easily measured. We must value the variables, but that doesn't fit with the bean counters. Feedback can so often be given in relation to basic competency, but I think professionals rely on motivation. They aspire to excellence, but if there's no component of excellence that's measured, and if there is no feedback in relation to excellence, then how do we get people to develop as individuals? And can you see a way of meeting that challenge?
Well, we're not going to promote excellence by defining minimum standards that learners have to pass. That's not excellence. We need to get people engaged in learning because they want to become good doctors. And they need to be immersed in transformational experiences, in workplaces, with the right relationships, pushing them, really, to drive to excellence. And I think that can be done. But it cannot be done if we allow politicians or whoever to cherry-pick on the easily measurable. What I find quite interesting and engaging of competency-based education is that we start to assess the unassessable, complex skills. And emerging research tells us that these kind of complex skills are very difficult to be measured in a traditional way. And if we do that, we get a reductionist practice. There's emerging fascinating research showing that words are much more powerful than scores. And I think we should be moving that way. That's what I meant with we shouldn't put metrics on things that are very difficult to put metrics on. And I think that we should use our language a lot more in our feedback and capturing that. And then documenting that and looking at consistencies on individuals. In the meantime, guiding them, coaching them, pushing them to excellence. And I think if we are able to create that engaging learning environment, we're able to do so. I think that in medicine we have the cream de la cream of learners. So if we can't do it, no one can do it. And I think it's our responsibility as a community that we make sure that our culture is not hijacked by the politicians. We are the professionals in the community, and we define how we use competency-based education.
Thank you all for your active participation. I'm going to challenge our panelists once more. We've covered a wide range of topics, and so even more challenging than putting you on the spot, not giving you much opportunity to prepare for the questions that were coming, I'm going to ask you to summarize what you think to be the key message that you heard this morning, or the most important topic that you think is going to define our field over the course of the next 50 years.
Have a random selection of who goes first, or
should I follow on, Kez?
Sure.
Just to follow on from the comment we just had earlier, which is around, I think they use that, the non-academic excellence. I think for me, there's going to be far more emphasis on the non-academic attributes, both in selection, but also within the curriculum, and we need to address that, I think, in terms of the research, to find the best ways of doing that. It also relates to me to a topic I'm very interested in at the moment, which is interprofessional learning, and how does one construct that in a way that's both meaningful and effective, and I think certainly a research gap in that particular area. I think my own personal goals, where I'd really like to see my work in selection go, is to look more at widening access, because like I said earlier, I've been struggling with that issue for almost 100 years and still haven't seemed to have solved it. So something I think will come in the next instance. There's certainly a political imperative, but I think there's also good now research evidence being built in that particular issue to help inform people with evidence-based solutions in future.
For me, and some of the comments, that I think we're entering an exciting era, hopefully an even golden era than what we're in. Our field is maturing and getting more sophisticated. We are adapting and embracing research paradigms. And for me, it's good that we're not challenging paradigms. We're actually getting the values from each and taking those forward for the greater good, which is really warming for me. We said before, and I say again, we need to be always thinking about those that we serve, the patients, but particularly the individuals that deliver our health service. I think we've got to, you know, value what we do and broadcast that widely. We do a good job. We're in conference season. We have all the clinical conferences that happen across the world. Do we have an education representation in these conferences? We need to start to break out to different arenas because we need to get our message out there that we can actually have huge impact. Some things maybe are not measurable. Moral excellence. But boy, sometimes the small things are the big things, and the unmeasurable things are the big things that we need to do. We have many challenges ahead. We have doctors who are facing a very complex, challenging, and it sometimes can be a detriment to their health. So we owe it to them to make sure we have a community that supports them through their patients. They need to be able to embrace complexity, to be adaptable, but most importantly, to be humane in everything that they do. And my last comment would be, if we want quality service, we need to look after those who look after our patients.
Okay, final word.
Well, I think medicine is an art. And I think education should be about developing artists. And I think we can do that to create learning environments that promote engagement through strong relationships with teachers, peer learners, patients, other healthcare workers. And I think we should be able to change the assessments in such a way that it embraces the complexity of reality. And I think that we can achieve that if we promote our community of practice in medical education as we currently are.
Thank you. I'm going to finish by sharing a quote that I fell in love with when I was exploring the back copies of the journal from our founding editor, Sir John Ellis, who, in speaking about how the field would move forward, spoke of the individuals who have had the greatest part to play, both in the government and the profession, have recognized the importance and complexity of the problem and have approached it with humility and discrimination. I think those are wonderful words for what we hope to encourage at the journal, and I encourage all of you to take them on board in your own endeavors and wish you the best. I certainly hope that we'll see all of you represented in our pages over the next 50 years. So thank you again for your active participation, making this session so easy to facilitate, and in particular, thank you to our panelists, Case, Jerry, and Fiona.
I want to take this moment to thank you all again for taking the time to listen to this. I obviously only record it because many of you have reported back that you enjoy the opportunity to hear from our authors in a different light, so to speak. So we'll keep doing that, but hope you will continue to let us know if there's ways in which we can make this a more useful product for you. Good luck with 2017, and as I said, with the next 50 years, we will look forward to seeing your submissions and hopefully featuring you on this podcast at some point in the near future.